Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out on another beautiful spring day. So lovely. So periodically, we do a Dharma seminar series on one of the chants in our chant book. And on Wednesday evenings, we don't do a chanting service very often. And so those of you who come on Sundays have done more of that. And the one that I've chosen to talk about is not one that we do very often. We do it, we chant it more and when we have a longer session or retreat. But it's also very important not to leave it out, because it's a very significant early text in our tradition, and it's called the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So you can find that in your book. I don't know what page it is. 10?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. But we're not going to start it yet. When you first encounter it, those of you who have chanted this before, you might have a kind of, what is that about? What is that all about? There's some strange language. A silver bowl filled with snow. Baba Wawa. You will see in there. Tethered colts and trapped rats. As with some other Zen texts, we could use a little help decoding this one, maybe even more than some other ones. But I think with a little effort, we can uncover much wisdom and beauty in this very old poem. It's a poem. So let's try it. Still no sign of that other Zendo, huh? There they are. There's Michael.
Oh.
They've appeared.
And Daikon.
Can you hear us at the other Zendo? Yes. Can you hand out your chant books? And be ready on page 10. You have missed just a very short introduction. So this poem, The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, is believed to have been written by Dongshan Lianjie, who was the founder of our school of Zen called Saodong in Chinese, in the Tang Dynasty in China. So that's the 9th century. So that's a long time ago. And Saodong becomes Soto in Japanese. Dongshan's disciple, Zhaoshan, was considered the co-founder of that school of Zen, which came to be called Saodong, taking the first syllable of each of their names. In case you ever wondered what Soto meant, or it's just the two syllables from these, from their names. And Shan, the second syllable of each name, refers to the mountain. Monasteries were called, and then the abbots of those monasteries were called by the name of the mountain where the monastery was in those days. So Shan is mountain. Now you may think this is just a little bit of Zen trivia, but really it's no small thing to be named after a mountain, don't you think? It'd be kind of wonderful to be named, called by the name of the mountain. Dogen, who was the Japanese monk who went to China and brought this style of practice back to Japan 500 years after Dongshan lived, Dogen left extensive writings behind for us, and we've talked about many of his writings. But Dongshan left no written record of his teachings, and most of the texts of those that early era of Zen were not recorded. Many of the teachings were not recorded until many years after the teachers had died. In Dongshan's case, the earliest existing compilation of his recorded sayings, they call it the recorded sayings of Dongshan, are 800 years after his death. Though many of the stories about him can be found in some of the earlier collections of koans, what became what we call now koans, or these anecdotes, stories, exchanges between teacher and student. And along with that collection of stories and sayings, there are a number of teaching poems, and this is one of them. Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. But this doesn't even appear in any text before 1119, when it was first published. So, you know, a long time after Dongshan lived. But nonetheless, it has been attributed to him ever since. Before we look at the poem itself, I want to talk a little bit about Dongshan, what's known about him. He lived from 807 to 869, and he was a contemporary of the great Rinzai Zen master Rinchi. And little is known about his family background. The first story in the record tells of a childhood incident where he was reading the Heart Sutra with his tutor, and he came to the words, which many of you know: no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, for those of you who have chanted the Heart Sutra. And the young boy, whose name is Liang Jian, said, "But I have eyes, ears, a nose, a tongue," and so forth. "Why does the sutra say they don't exist?" And that's a question that may have occurred to some of us the first time we ever read the Heart Sutra. It's a good question. But Liangjie's tutor was so impressed with the boy's probing mind that he said, "I'm not capable of being your teacher." And he recommended that he go seek a Chan master, Chan being Chinese for Zen. I think this little story from his childhood foreshadows his lifelong interest in reconciling the paradox of the two truths, the absolute and the relative, the unity, the reality of infinite unity and of particularity, difference. How do you reconcile with that seeming paradox? From the perspective of the absolute, as the Heart Sutra tells us, all phenomena are empty, or perhaps a better translation is boundless, because they're not empty in the way we think of emptiness, so much as empty of separate existence, no separate existence apart from vast interconnection with everything throughout space and time. So that's what emptiness means in this context. And that's the perspective of the absolute. And from the perspective of the everyday world is sometimes referred to as an illusion or a dream, which is both helpful and not helpful. Because, of course, we have to live and function in this relative world. And if we walk out, if we've got our earbuds in, and if we walk out in front of a truck, it's not just an illusion. This lectern was once a living tree, and now it's a hard object. And if I drop it on my foot, it'll hurt, because my living body will alert itself that it's been damaged. So we live, it's not that all of this material stuff is an illusion, so much that it is in constant flux and interrelationship. So going back to the young Liang Jie, he did go to a Chan temple, and he took novice precepts and was fully ordained at the age of 21. And then, as young monks did, he traveled from one monastery to another. They used to walk on foot long distances through the mountains to practice with different teachers. And the question that led him to his primary teacher, Yunyan, was about non-sentient beings speaking or teaching the Dharma. Does that sound familiar? Some of us have read, there's a wonderful text by Dogen about insentient beings teaching the Dharma with these dialogues between Dongshan and his teacher Yunyan. Dongshan studied with Yunyan for some years and then he went traveling again. And before he left, he asked Yunyan, he said, "Later on, if I'm asked to describe your teaching, how should I respond?" Yunyan paused. And then he said, "Just this is it." Dongshan didn't respond. He was just quiet and thought about his teacher's words. And then Yunyan added, "You are now in charge of this great matter. You must be thoroughgoing." Sent him off. And later, Dongshan, out on the mountain path, was wading across a stream. He looked down and he saw his own reflection. And as the record says, he awakened to the meaning of his exchange with his teacher. And as Zen masters and monks did in those days, when you had an awakening experience, you composed a verse. This is his verse. "Just don't seek from others or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone, everywhere I need it. It is now me. I now am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness." So here's this word, suchness. You won't find it in an English dictionary, but it's one that Buddhist scholars have coined to translate the Sanskrit word tatata. And it's also sometimes called thusness. Thusness, suchness, means reality just as it is, both boundless and specific, both absolute and relative, right now, right in this moment, in this place. So when he says merging with suchness or merging with thusness, it could be called the merging of difference and unity, absolute and relative. That's the title of another important Zen poem, which we do chant more often, called Merging of Difference and Unity. The word it in this verse, "I now go on alone, everywhere I meet it. It now is me, I now am not it," can be translated apparently as it, but also as him. So it could be both referring to suchness and also to his teacher, Yunyan. So we could read the same verse as, "Just don't seek from others or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone everywhere I meet him. He is now me. I now am not him." So he is able to kind of see, although he's left his teacher is all around him in the trees, in the water, in the sunlight. "It now is me, I now am not it." In his poem that he wrote then, comes up again in Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, where he says, "You are not it, but in truth it is you." So you'll see that. Dongshan sees his reflection. He sees his reflection and he realizes that all conceptions of the self are fleeting, mutable, changing, like images in the water. And yet, at the same time, he's completely interconnected with the stream, the spring breeze, the grasses springing up from the soil. There he is, a living being, in that moment crossing the stream. I wonder if any of you, of us, have had a moment like that out in the natural world, or maybe right here on the city street, where it's just right now, this moment, you in the world and everything else around you, right here, right now. So these teachings about thusness form the core of this poem. So I want to give you this little background before we start it. So now we'll start. First, the title, The Jewel Mirror. We could say the jewel mirror is Buddha nature. Our nature, when we're not hemmed in and bound in by our conditioned habit patterns, when our view is unclouded, when we're not in the grip of greed or aversion or delusion. And when we see with our Dharma eye open, we see Buddha nature reflected right back to us, all around us, in each other and in the world. Maybe that's what Dongshan saw in the stream as he waded across, the jewel mirror reflecting back Buddha nature. Jewel mirror, and then samadhi is that unobstructed state where obstructions drop away, of clear heart and mind, the state from which we see the jewel mirror. So jewel mirror samadhi. So let's look at the poem. Let's read the first four lines. The teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, so keep it well. So he's referring to, you know, the transmission of this teaching of thusness from teacher to student, from the time of the Buddha, all those hundreds and hundreds of years. But it's always been clear that this transmission of the teachings is kind of figure of speech, that there's nothing actually transmitted. There's a mutual dropping away of obstruction, a mutual recognition of thusness, just as it is right now. In the very first story of transmission, it is of the Buddha holding up a flower, and Mahakashyapa smiles without even any words. Just this flower, just this call of the flower and response of the smile, the self in touching the world. That's the story of the first Dharma transmission. So then the line, now you have it, keep it well, is sort of reminiscent of Dongshan's teacher, Yunyan's parting words. You are now in charge of this great matter. You must be most thoroughgoing. There's a koan in one of the collections of koans where Dongshan says something similar to his student, Zhaoshan, after teaching him the jewel mirror samadhi verse. He teaches him this poem, and then he says, keep it well and don't let it be cut off. Later, if you meet a true vessel of the Dharma, only then should you pass it on. So the legend is that this verse was kind of a secret transmission that was passed from teacher to student. But today, it's part of our chant book, and we all can chant it in Soto Zen temples all around the world. So in a sense, we all now have it, the teaching of suchness, and we all have the responsibility to care for that, care for our practice, to take care of our practice together and carry it forward. So let's look at the next four lines. Filling a silver bowl with snow, finding a heron in the moonlight, taken as similar, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. So that's maybe a little confusing, maybe a little paradoxical, but Dongshan is using these beautiful images to express again that dialectic between the universal and the particular, the relative and the absolute. So the silver bowl in the first line and the moonlight in the second line symbolize the absolute, the undifferentiated, or the awakened mind. And the snow in the first line and the white heron, or probably it was an egret in the second line, are the particularities in the phenomenal world. So the next two lines describe how an awakened person sees these phenomena, able to see the distinctions without judgment, just as they are. So not losing sight of the white bird in the moonlight and not being disappointed when it flies away. The white heron in the moonlight, silver bowl filled with snow. The image of the snow and the silver bowl alludes to another story, a Dharma transmission story from ancient India. When the great sage Nagarjuna presents his student Kanadeva with a silver bowl of water, and Kanadeva drops a needle into the silver bowl filled with water. A needle in those days would have been one of the monk's few possessions. Monk had the robe, the begging bowl, and the needle to mend the robes. So the single needle dropping into the still water is this beautiful image of phenomenon arising within clear awareness. Right? Here's the still water in the bowl. Single needle drops in. A moment of arising of a phenomenon, and then still again. Just like the sound of a bird, there's out where we live in the country, there's a bird called a varied thrush. It's similar to a robin, but different, and it lives in the forest. And it's one of the first birds you hear in the spring, and it just has this single quavery flute-like note. It's just so kind of evocative. It's like this needle dropping into the bowl of water. Or it might be the piercing cry of a frightened child. Wake up, right? An awakened body-mind responds to the call, whatever it is, appropriately and naturally. Next four lines. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. So meaning is not in the words. Words fall short of the actual experience in the moment. And yet, we must inquire. We must respond. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Do you ever feel like that? When you speak and act impulsively, you can get yourself into big trouble. On the other hand, if you're seized by anxiety, second-guessing yourself and everybody else, you fall into paralysis and you can't respond. Doubt and vacillation, right? Thusness is just the right response for this moment. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. Not turning away, not grabbing on. Can we do that? Can we meet each moment just the way it is? He's saying this vast wonder of just one moment of thusness is like a massive fire. As soon as we try to put it into words, we've already stained it, we've already distorted it. And yet, being human beings, beings of language. We try anyway. Next verse goes, it is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. It acts as a guide for beings. Its use removes all pains. So there's a lot of it's in this verse. So if we substitute just this for the it, let's read the lines again. Just this, thusness. Just this is bright just at midnight. Just this doesn't appear at dawn. Just this acts as a guide for beings. Just this removes all pains. So that imagery of light and darkness might recall the words from that other poem I mentioned, Merging of Difference and Unity. Some of you know it well. It goes, in the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. So in the light, we can see distinctions. In the darkness, distinctions disappear. So the relative and the absolute. Yet within the light, the phenomenal world is still all connected. The absolute is still there. And within the dark, there's still particularity. And so he expresses that in is bright just at midnight, it doesn't appear at dawn. And when we deeply see into this reality, this non-dual reality of thusness, we're released from suffering. And this removes all pains. No light without darkness, no life without death. No nirvana without samsara, no enlightenment without delusion. How could there be, right? Just this is it. I was thinking as I was reading all this and preparing the talk that the Japanese poetic form of haiku is sort of the quintessential poetry of just this is it. Because it's a meeting of a moment fully with body and mind. It's a sort of call and response to the moment of the world, brought right down to earth, to this moment. It's haiku often, it always, shouldn't say always because it's, but typically has a reference, a sensory reference to experiencing the changing of the seasons. It's usually a season experienced through these eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. The great haiku poet Basho was really the one through his Zen practice who made haiku into a Zen art. And he went on long pilgrimages through Japan on foot, sometimes on a horse, mostly on foot. Or staying in the, he would stay periodically in a little hut. And he made many haiku just of a moment of thusness. Like, I think I just read this one recently. Shizukasa ya iwa ni shimi iru semi no koi. The stillness, soaking into the stones, cicada's song. If you've ever heard, been to Japan and heard really, really loud cicadas, you could imagine it splitting a stone or soaking into the stone. There are two versions of that one. And the second one, instead of the word stillness, he uses the word loneliness. Loneliness. Soaking into the stones, cicada's song. There's something, somehow, there's a stillness in the loneliness, and a loneliness in the stillness. Basho didn't just write about the beautiful in life. If he was sick or lonely or uncomfortable, he wrote a haiku about just that. not just that in a narrow self-centered sense. His haiku are always about self in relation to the world. Ukiware o sabishigaraseyo, kankodori. This wandering life, the cuckoo's call deepens my loneliness. Utabirite yadokaru oroyo, fuji no hana. Weary from travel, I search for lodging. Wisteria flowers. There's a saying that I love in Japanese that comes from tea ceremony. It goes, ichigo ichie, one moment, one meeting. So in tea ceremony, the host and the guest meet only this once, never to be repeated, which is true of any of our meetings, right? This moment right now, never to be repeated. So ichigo ichie, each moment, one meeting. Meet it wholeheartedly, meet it fully. With your whole self, even if that self, even if you're in pain, even if you're lonely, meet it that way, meet it as you are, just that way. So I want to encourage you as we go through this text to read it to yourself out loud. It's on the website, on the sort of event posting for this Dharma seminar. There's a PDF of it if you want to print it out. And don't try to figure it out. Just kind of read it like poetry with a sense of kind of openness, and let some of the images kind of just percolate inside you. Let just this is it, surprise you. Just around the corner, maybe. You might even write a haiku. So I'm going to stop talking and invite you to share some reflections. And here's how we'll do it. I think we're going to make not such small groups. Maybe, how many do we have here? Well, actually, what we'll do is excuse the folks over in the other Zendo to arrange yourselves as you see fit over there. And what I want to ask everybody to do is, if you'd like, share just this moment that you may have experienced lately, or just something, you know, is there a line or a phrase from the poem that somehow resonated for you? Okay. And remember, put the Zoom folks, you could just put them in maybe just one group. Well, and each person, we're going to try having little larger groups. So each person could just speak for a couple of minutes, not too long. And then we'll go around the each small circle, and it's fine to just pass if you aren't ready to speak or don't have something that you'd like to share at that time. And just, yeah, speak. It's a practice of it's not a discussion. It's more of a practice of speaking from the heart and listening from the heart, each person. Question?
Yeah, shall we take time to make sure we read the poem before we talk?
Just the part that I've
just
read.
That part.
Yeah, so just let's group ourselves, and then everybody just, you know, take a moment to reread the section, which goes up to, where did it